Trevor Denman burst onto the announcing scene in 1983 when the South African was hired to call the Oaktree meet at Santa Anita. American racing fans had never heard anyone quite like him. He didn't just announce a race, he painted a picture. He had a collection of colorful terms, and he wasn't afraid to editorialize if he thought a horse was, quote-unquote, moving like a winner. Now 65, Denman works only the Del Mar meets, but remains as good as ever. Denman is this week's guest on the Thoroughbred Daily News podcast, brought to you by TaylorMade.
Why do TaylorMade horses sell for nearly double the market average? A history of success, honesty, and hard work. For over 40 years, buyers and sellers alike have trusted TaylorMade as the industry's top source for high-quality thoroughbreds and friendly service. While sellers get top dollar for their horses, buyers are rewarded for top results on the track. From sale toppers to Grade 1 winners to Breeders' Cup champions, think TaylorMade, the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing.
Welcome back. This is Bill Finley, the host of the TDN podcast, and we're pleased to be joined by Trevor Denman. It's impossible to say who is the best racetrack announcer in the history of racing, but Denman is on virtually everyone's list. And Trevor, when you started calling in the U.S., the way most announcers called a race was pretty routine. They simply told you where the horses were in the race, position by position. You are far more descriptive. Where and when did you develop that sort of style?
You know, it all goes back to geography, I believe. The American announcers basically were an extension of the chart callers. You know, the chart callers are there just for the daily racing form. Their job is not to be colorful at all. It's to get the guy who's writing the call down all the information. So they were seventh by a head, eighth by a half, ninth by two, and it meant nothing to the public. It meant a lot to the chart callers. And when they transitioned over to race calling, unfortunately, they just brought the chart caller into the announcer's booth. And that's what he thought he had to do, was just call the chart. So there was no description whatsoever. And that's just the way it happened. And in English racing or South African racing, where the tracks are huge, you know, they're normally 2 miles in circumference, and like a track like Goodwood, they actually run away from you into the woods. It's extremely difficult to call the races. I've called a couple of races at Goodwood. And of course, the people in the grandstands have no idea what's going on because the horses are a mile away. So you have to, it's just, that's the way it is. You have to be more descriptive. Besides, we had regular fields, you know, in South Africa, we would race twice a week. There'd be 9 races a day, and 6 of those races would have a field of at least 20. So you had to be descriptive. If we'd gone through so-and-so's 17th by a neck, he's 18th by a head, 19th by a two, it would have been ludicrous. So it was just really a matter of geography of where you were brought up, how descriptive you were.
Okay. Were you worried that this style wouldn't go over well in the U.S.?
You know, I wasn't. I was fairly young, and I just listened to them. In 1976, someone came to America. Now, you must remember, in those days, South Africa and America were different planets. Mm-hmm. People in America were living on Pluto. We were living on Earth kind of thing, or you can reverse that. It doesn't matter. You get the gist. And I'd never heard an American announcer. We were weaned on the English, the Irish, and the Australian announcers. And a guy bought me a record back. It was this old vinyl record in 1976. And I listened to it, and I said, man, these guys aren't descriptive. You know, I think I'm onto something here. And I played the two together in my head and said, who can ever go for eighth by a head, ninth by a nose, when you could be much more descriptive? So I don't want to appear arrogant, but I was very confident that it would go over. Of course, it could have flopped, but I was lucky enough that it didn't.
Well, you're right. It's gone over tremendously well. As I said earlier in the introduction, you certainly are on the quote-unquote Mount Rushmore of American announcers.
Well, thank you.
Okay. But for lack of a better phrase, the public really embraced you. They loved what you did. Why do you think that is? Is it because of this style? Is there something more to that? Not only are you regarded as a good announcer, you're very popular.
I hope so.
Okay.
I always say famous, I say no, infamous, so I'm not sure about that. You know, I would put that all down to one word, sagacity. Mm-hmm. I think that's what the people like, is when you have sagacity. You know, it's no good just being a voice, or just being loud, or just, you know, trying to make false excitement. I think you have to look at it from the point of view of the guy who's listening. What does he want? Not what do I want. What does he want? And I'm an altruistic person. I'm a Libra. Libras are just naturally altruistic. And I think that's what it was. Don't worry about yourself. Worry about what the fans want to hear. And I think the big thing, one of the biggest things, we threw humor into it. The American announcers back in the 60s and the 70s were extremely stern. You know, they were dour. Mm-hmm. There was no humor whatsoever. And I think the public actually liked that. You know, in South Africa, when we would call when we were younger, I mean, you could use a phrase like, so-and-so's clear by six. You can head back to the pub and order another one because this one's over. You know, throw some humor in. And I think the people there loved it. I mean, the majority of the people were 20 to 40-year-old males, so they liked that. So I think sagacity would be my key word, followed by humor.
Okay. Now, one of the things you're also well known for is certain catchphrases. He has to sprout wings to catch so-and-so. He's out there moving like a winner, coming like an express train. Were those things that just popped into your mind? Or I know Tom Durkin, we've talked a lot about, he actually, you know, works on things like that and has notebooks. Is this something, those sort of phrases, things that you had to work on, or did they just sort of naturally pop into your mind?
You know, let me tell you a story about those. I picked them up gradually, and some of them were really in curious ways. Yeah, I was in England once at a small jump track in England, and I got to meet the announcer. He was a young guy. To this day, I can't remember his name. And of course, you can't steal from American announcers. That's a big no-no. You know, I wouldn't even dream of taking a saying from an American announcer. But it was a small track. I believe it was Bangor on Dee in England. Mm-hmm. And they turned farmers, you know, steeplechasers, they go, well, who's in front by 20. And he said they would need to sprout wings to catch this guy. And I said, that's me. I'm in there. The other one, I was in a taxi cab in New York City. And the guy asked me, we were going to Belmont Racetrack. He said, what do you do? I told him. He knew who I was. He was like, oh, my God, I know who you are. And he started telling me these racing stories. And he said, I bet this horse, man, and it was clear by four lengths, and I knew I could ring up the register. I said, hello, that's me, ring up the register. Coming from a cabbie in New York City, I knew the people would go for it. So it's kind of things like that. I think coming like an express train just developed by itself. I think it's just descriptive mm-hmm. of a horse really flying. You know, those express trains, especially the old steam trains back mm-hmm. in the 40s and 50s, when they built up a head of steam, that's what a racehorse looked like when he was flying down the lane. So it's a culmination of a number of different scenarios.
Okay. Trevor, in 2015, while still very much at the top of your game, you decided to walk away from what is one of the most prestigious announcing jobs in racing, Santa Anita. And just tell us why.
Yeah, I know there's been a number of takes on that, but I'll tell you the absolute truth is that my wife, Robin, and I, we bought a farm in Minnesota in 1996. It sits on 500 acres, and it's absolutely idyllic. I mean, it's in the middle of nowhere. We can't see another human being. The closest farmer is just over a mile away, and we can just see the top of his silo. So to me, it's just, you know, it's bliss. And we decided that there's more to life than horse racing. You know, we loved horse racing. It's been very good to me, but life is way bigger than horse racing. And I always said there will come a day when I just don't want to do this anymore. And it was building up. And then one day I was sitting in the booth at Santa Anita. And the Santa Anita booth is a little claustrophobic. It's a small booth, and it's on top of the roof. You know, you can look out, but you can't see anything behind, as opposed to Del Mar, where you're on top of the roof, and you can see the Pacific Ocean behind you as magnificent scenery. So you feel free at Del Mar. Nothing against the Santa Anita booth, but it was a little claustrophobic. And I was sitting there on a Thursday afternoon, and there was a 20-minute gap between races, and that's when the snowstorm just hit me. You know, it was like an avalanche. I said, what am I doing? I'm sitting in this booth. My life is ticking away second by second. I'm 64 years old. I've probably got another 20, 30 years on this planet. I've got to dedicate my life to myself. I cannot dedicate it to Santa Anita. So I decided then and there that was it. I don't want to do Santa Anita anymore. And the main thing was to live my life. If there was to be another factor that influenced me, it was the traffic. Oh, my goodness, the Los Angeles traffic has just become diabolical. I lived about 20 minutes from Santa Anita. It was taking me an hour and a half to get home. and you're tired, you're irritable at the end of the day, you get in your car and you don't go anywhere. You average like 3 miles an hour. So that was really tedious. So I put them all together and I just said, no, my life is more important than this. And I knew, you know, I've heard a bit of criticism, like I dropped Santa Anita. It's just absolute rubbish. We got along very well. Keith Brackpool, who ran Santa Anita at that time, and I were good buddies. He's a soccer fanatic. I'm a soccer fanatic. I had zero, absolutely nothing against Santa Anita. I was lucky enough to work there for like 40 years and never had one standoff with management. Not ever, I can say. So it had nothing to do with them. It was all about Trevor Denman and his life. And, you know, I gave them 6 weeks' notice. I knew, my goodness, they could get an announcer from anywhere in the world to start at Santa Anita tomorrow. You could call any English announcer and say, listen, you've got the job at Santa Anita. I want you here at noon tomorrow. And the guy would be there, let alone the American announcers. I knew there would be 20 of them lining up. So I didn't drop Santa Anita at all. And if there had been some weird situation where they couldn't get an announcer, of course I would have gone back for another month or 3 months until they could find an announcer. So they can quash that one that, you know, I put Santa Anita behind the black ball. That is rubbish. I knew they would have an announcer within 2 days.
And, of course, they hired an excellent one in Michael Rona to take your place.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes.
An eighth of a mile to go, and Collected keeps on going. Arrogate's getting going late now. Collected is in front. Arrogate closing on the outside. It's a Bob Baffert 1-2, but Collected going to win it. Collected and Martin Garcia won the Pacific Classic.
Well, you just heard Trevor Denman's stretch call the 2017 Pacific Classic run at Del Mar, which is now his only employer when it comes to horse racing. Trevor, you already spoke about how the view from the booth at Del Mar is so idyllic. So you've pretty much answered the question why Del Mar is the lone track that you decided to remain at. But what else about Del Mar makes it so special to you? To myself, an East Coast person that hasn't spent a whole lot of time out there, I don't know as much about the Del Mar mystique as a West Coast person. So tell us more. Why is Del Mar so special to you?
Well, I can tell you one thing, you know, compared it maybe to Saratoga, but Del Mar, the girls beat them hands down. Del Mar women are the prettiest in America, so that's a big plus there.
Is it okay if your wife, now your wife will be listening to this podcast? You know,
she knows I'm joking.
Okay.
And second of all is the weather. I mean, Saratoga has some diabolical weather, you
right.
know, and it's humid and it rains a lot. Del Mar, I always say the television person has it made, the guy who's got to type in all the facts and figures. He can just type in on day one, weather 77 degrees, wind 2 degrees out of the west, and he never needs to change that graphic. It's the same every single day. I think the main Del Mar meet, the July-August meet, it's probably rained, I'm going to say, 3 times in the last 30 years. So the weather is just absolutely superb. And then, of course, another big factor is management. You know, Joe Harper is the general manager. Joe helped me out back in 1984. I only worked at Oak Tree, which is only a 6-week meet. So I really needed another job. And he immediately hired me at Del Mar. So that really eased a monetary problem there. You know, we all went from 6 weeks to like 13 weeks in one hit. He really helped me out. He's the greatest guy in the world. If anybody has a bad word about Joe Harper, then you need to reassess why you're on this planet. Everybody likes Joe Harper. And it's a trickle-down effect. The whole Del Mar management is that they just get along so well. I always say you can judge a company by the hiring and firing. If people are getting fired all the time, there's something wrong with the company, not with the people. And Del Mar, you could use the word, I don't know anybody, never been fired. I think the only people who leave Del Mar are the people who retire. So that's a huge thing. You go to work just feeling good. You go to work with friends. People don't tell you what to do. They ask you what to do.
We'll be right back with more from Trevor Denman. But first, this message from our friends and sponsors at TaylorMade.
TaylorMade, where customer success is our primary focus.
Ladies and gentlemen, we present Harvard of Grace.
7-10. You want to get 10 million, Hunter? Right here, we're going to get out of the mats away. Now it's 10. 10-10. Here, we're going to get out of the mat. 10. Bruce, right here, $10 million even.
TaylorMade, where customer success is our primary focus. But don't take our word for it. Here's what some of our most satisfied customers have to say.
This is Brian Kahn, Los Angeles, California. I've been associated with, worked for, and been a client of TaylorMade and the TaylorMade family for close to 30 years now. Had great success with them, They've always been transparent and honest, and I always felt I was getting the right end of the deal with them. Highly recommend their services, from boarding, public sales, private sales. I've used all. All have been a success and a pleasure to deal with.
Here's longtime TaylorMade client Rick Porter of Fox Hill Farms, owner of numerous champions and grade one winners, such as 2011 Horse of the Year, Havre de Grace.
I've been doing business with TaylorMade for over 20 years. Everyone knows they are the best sellers at auction, but they have also done great work for me in the private market. They have an unbelievable network that can help you buy or sell privately in a very professional and transparent way. I wish I had these guys working for me when I was in the car business.
Discover what TaylorMade can do for you. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com.
Trevor, you already told us what you do when you're not announcing at Del Mar. You go back to Minnesota to your farm. To somebody who is not a fan of cold weather, it doesn't sound that great to spend the winters in Minnesota. Obviously, there's something you love about it. Tell us more. What is the name of the town? Kellogg, Minnesota?
It's Kellogg, yes. The Kellogg's a little village. It's only about 200 people. The closest actual town would be Wabasha, and you might know the name Wabasha from Grumpy Old Men. That was filmed and seen around Wabasha. That's its claim to fame. There's a bar there that where they shot Grumpy Old Men, so that's their claim to fame. That's a city of about, it's a town of about 2,500. But I tell you what, I just love what you said, and you know, not being facetious, but just keep saying that. Say the weather in Minnesota is terrible, it's horrible, I don't know how you put up with it, because there's only, 4.5-5 million Minnesotans, and the vast majority of them live in Minneapolis, so keep people away, and the weather is just so, so overrated. You know, back in 1860, when you had to go and work out in the fields, yes, it would have been really, really horrible. But right now, when you think about it, I mean, think of the average guy. He gets up, he's in a heated house, okay? He doesn't know it's snowing outside. These days, you push a button from your lounge and your car starts and the heat comes on. So by the time you get out to your car, it's heated. It's all the ice is off the windows and that. You get in a heated car, you drive to work, you park underground, and you go into a heated office. It's kind of like, what cold? And of course, I have the massive advantage that I don't have to work. So I can sit inside, watch soccer, and drink beer. I don't care if it's snowing outside. It really doesn't matter to me. This was my first really long winter, the first entire winter I've spent in Minnesota. And according to the people, it was one of the worst in the last few decades. And man, it didn't affect me at all. So I think you have to be realistic. It's 2018 now, not 1918, and the weather's not that bad. If you had to go to work every day, the worst thing would be you might have to shovel your driveway to get the car out. But other than that, oh, and of course, you know, you use your common sense, and if it's cold, you dress warmly.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand not only do you take a break from work, but I've read that you really take a break from racing, that you're not tuned into TVG every day. I think I read somewhere that you might watch the Kentucky Derby for the first time a week after its run, which seems unusual for somebody who's dedicated so much of their life to racing. But is it important for you to really just get that total break from the sport?
Yes. I own racehorses in South Africa, so I watch the South African racing on Twin Spires every now and then. Well, quite a lot. That's the most racing I watch. And I watch some of the English racing. But to start with the American racing, when I got here in 1983, wow, it was just a shock for the animal cruelty. I mean, we can all look back 30 years later now and see that was shocking. I mean, for me, it was just like, oh my goodness, this is not happening. Let me give you an example. Peter O'Sullivan, the most famous announcer in England ever, came over here to call a race in the 70s, and he went to Aqueduct. And after about the third race, he just couldn't take it. He said, no, there's something wrong here. This is animal cruelty. So he walked into the steward's room, and there was a steward swinging back on his chair, and he said, let me ask you, do you guys have a problem with jockeys whipping these horses? And the guy looked up and said, nah, our jocks whip pretty good. You know, he didn't get it. He didn't get it. So I was really revolted by the cruelty. That's why we started that whole whip campaign, which I'm happy to say went very successfully. You know, watching a race now and watching a race in 1984 is two different things. Those whips were absolutely, they were so heavy. They didn't have feathers on them. Jockeys hit the horse anywhere they liked. I think we've come a long, long way. I love it now at Del Mar where you're not allowed to hit a horse more than four times in a row. And they maul, they backhand us now. They're not that malicious swing from the shoulder. And the whips are, you know, the old days you took a whip and you hit your hand, you had a welt. You'd have a bruise and a welt for a couple of days. Now you can take these whips and hit your hand as hard as you like and it doesn't leave anything. It's totally, totally changed. And the old claiming days, you know, it just drove me insane. When they would say a horse was dropping from $32,000 claimer into a $10,000 claimer, and they put like dropping to cash. No, dropping because the horse has a major ailment. This horse could break down and die, and it wasn't funny. So that's changed a lot too. Now, we still have a few trainers who do that, but that's changed. So it was very, very hard to me as an animal rights person to watch this cruelty going on. And I think I perhaps still have a little bit of a hangover, although we've come 90% of the way. I love watching South African racing. If you watch Twin Spires, just watch tomorrow. I don't care who wins. Watch the entire field. And in a 12-horse field, probably 7, 8 of the jockeys won't even pull their stick. They won't pull it. And the ones who do, they'll give the horse 1, 2 taps, and that's it. You know, guy hit my horse one day 7 times, and I mean, like I was onto the trainer, like, I don't want that guy riding my horse again. Mm-hmm. He hit it 7 times. We've had notorious races here, Kentucky Derbies, where a jockey's hit a horse 42 times. So that's what kind of sours me off a little about the racing.
Understood, and you've always been at the forefront of many of these issues. Let me ask you this question. Might it just be easier if whipping were banned, period? Would you go that far?
Oh, yeah, okay. Categorically.
Yes.
I know you've always been on my side on this one from 30 years ago. And people say, ooh, jockeys need to carry a whip for safety. That is absolute rubbish. When a horse bolts, a horse gets to the 3/8 pole and he bolts to the outside. He is no longer in his mind, okay? The horse has gone insane. You could hit him with an electric shock. He's not coming back. He's going to go off the track. He's going where he wants to go. And you see these guys pull their stick and they hit them over the head. I've never seen a horse straighten up from that in life. So one of two things. I say you don't need whips at all. There would still be a pick six. There'd still be 9 winners every day. No one would know if they ran in 1:10 or 1:11 for 6 furlongs. Nobody on the racetrack, not even, you know, the top trainer in the country, wouldn't know a 1 second. Racing would not change. If you want to let them carry a whip, okay. But they should make the South African rules where you just hit them backhanders or you tap them down the neck. I mean, it's so simple to do. And they're doing it in other parts of the world. Even England, you seldom see a jockey pulley stick. But please go to Twin Spires on Saturday morning and there's a big meeting in South Africa in Cape Town. Just watch the jockeys. I mean, that we could do that tomorrow. And not only would it save the horses, it would help the image of horse racing. I mean, I have seen so many kids in 9, 10, 11 years old, and they watch a horse race and they just say, that's disgusting. I'm not going to the racetrack. You know, people these days, especially the kids, are much more sensitive than they were 40, 50 years ago in the fact that they don't want animals to be abused. You know, have you seen circuses closing down? Have you seen zoos closing down? They're still zoos, but the animals now have acres and acres of ground to walk on. They're not in a little steel cage with a cement floor that's 5x5. So zoos are gone. Circuses are gone. People are much more sensitive to animal welfare. The thing that bothers me with horse racing, and I just kind of threw in the towel, after 30 years, you can't keep going hitting your head on the wall, but it's so easy to change, but it's arrogance and bigotry that won't allow it to change. Just change the rules and go on with it. Watch Gary Stevens ride today. Watch Mike Smith. Watch Rafael Bejarano, Joel Rosario. I mean, you're talking about 4 of the greatest jockeys ever. Joel Rosario, you know, he's probably the best jockey in America right now. And that's not being denigrating to any of the other riders. Joel Rosario can come from last, win by a nose, and he doesn't even pick his stick up. He reminds me of the old Eddie Dalhousie. Those are jockeys. But just watch Joel Rosario today, Gary Stevens, Mike Smith, Rafael Bejarano. Those are 4 that come to mind. I'm sure there's many more. They don't whack these horses. And do they win races? Of course they do. Whips are just so overrated. We could do away with it tomorrow, but it's called arrogance.
An interesting take on that subject. We will talk Breeders' Cup and some of Trevor Denman's greatest calls when we return. But first, this message from our sponsor, TaylorMade.
And here it is. The 37-year wait is over. American Foal is finally the one. American Foal has won the Triple Crown.
Over
Over the past four decades, TaylorMade has risen from a small boarding operation to the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing. Here's Hall of Fame trainer Jerry Hollendorfer.
TaylorMade sales follow many horses that are training at the racetrack, and they are particularly adept at evaluating mares and placing them with a proper stallion after their racing careers are over. They are very straightforward and are also experts on confirmation of younger weanlings and yearlings.
My name is Tia Andrini, and I am from San Mateo, California. I've been doing business with TaylorMade for about a year now, and it's been one great experience after another. It started with my first TaylorMade venture when I bought an interest in the filly Catherine Sophia, which ultimately landed me 3 weeks later in the middle of the winner's circle of the 2016 Kentucky Oaks with her. The TaylorMade team is a group of truly outstanding individuals. They are knowledgeable, professional, and completely customer service driven. To me, the TaylorMade name epitomizes the term trusted advisor. That is exactly what they are, and I am very proud to be associated and doing business with them.
Discover what TaylorMade can do for you. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com.
And now here's Zenyatta, and let's see. Zenyatta has a lot of ground to make up. Zenyatta, if she wins this, she'll be a super horse. She's starting to pick them off, though. Zenyatta going to hook to the outside. Meanwhile, it's Colonel John Summerbird in the red cap. And Zenyatta's come to the outside. Zenyatta coming flying on the grandstand side. Gio Ponti on the inside. Summerbird is right there. This is unbelievable. Zenyatta, what a performance. One we'll never forget.
That call of Zenyatta winning the 2009 Breeders' Cup Classic is thought of as perhaps your greatest call ever. Trevor, I imagine you, like everyone else watching, had goosebumps all over your body. Just tell us what went through your mind and what do you remember about that race?
I always used to say the greatest race was the 89 Preakness with Sunday Silence and Easy Goer. I mean, that was pretty much the quintessential horse race. They virtually went head and head from the opening of the gate. And Pat Day, Pat Valenzuela, you know, you can't get a better race than that until Zenyatta came along. That Breeders' Cup. And, you know, she was racing against the boys. It was the Breeders' Cup Classic. This was no pushover. She wasn't running against California Philly. She was running against the best horses in the world. And at the 3/8 poll, anybody who's not lying, anybody who has the courage to stand up and say, wow, at the 3/8 poll, I mean, she wasn't going to win. I don't think I said she won't win. I said something to the effect, if she wins this, she's a superstar. And it came to fruition because she did win and she is a superstar. And then at like the 3/16 poll, you figured, well, she's running on. I'd say she'll be in the money but can't win. And all of a sudden, it's almost like she just took one huge breath and just exploded that last. But you couldn't relive that, you know. And, you know, I never pre-plan a race call. It just it comes intrinsically. And that's when I used that unbelievable. I didn't mean to use it. It just popped out of my mind. But the cadence was perfect that the unbelievable went with her stride. I didn't mean it to happen that way, but that's how it did. So, you know, by a mile, the best race I've ever seen.
Another of Denman's most famous calls also included Zenyatta in the 2010 Breeders' Cup Classic.
And Zenyatta is dead last. Zenyatta is last. Mike Smith trying to find somewhere to run. They're bunching up at the top of the lane now, though. Haynesfield, Esquire City's running a huge one as well. Looking at Lucky. Here comes Looking at Lucky. Etched is in there. Zenyatta now hooking to the grandstand side. And Zenyatta is now coming with a run. Looking at Lucky. Blame. Blame on the inside. Blame gets the lead. Zenyatta on the outside. Looking at Lucky. Blame. Zenyatta. Zenyatta. Zenyatta is flying. Blame trying to hold on. Blame.
Trevor, you're a pro.
I wanted to run that race again. When
okay.
She got beat, I said, no, you guys are going to do that again. She's not allowed to get beaten.
Well, that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted.
We've got to do it again.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. You're a pro, but you're also a human. And I've read, and as most announcers, you don't bet on races that you call and you don't root.
No.
But there's definitely a note of disappointment in your voice when she lost. Was that the case?
Two races I've cheated. I've probably called, I'd say, somewhere around 100,000 races in my life. I've been doing it now for, what is it, I started in 71, 47 years, 47 years. And I've cheated in two races. That was Bill Shoemaker's last ride. I mean, anybody who didn't want Bill Shoemaker to win his last ride, please get a life, you know. And I think at the eighth pole, just to add to it, he was in with a winning chance. And I think I said something like, come on, Bill, you know, which is obviously a big no-no for an announcer. But that was one race I gave myself a bit of poetic license and just said, you can say whatever you want. Like I say, anybody didn't want Bill Shoemaker to win the last race of his career, well, get a life. And then the other one was when Zenyatta did lose that race. I mean, I was definitely biased towards her. Again, I mean, you want this horse to go out unbeaten. It's making history. And with all due respect to Blame, the connections, no, I don't mean this, but I mean, who's Blame compared to Zenyatta, you know? So yes, I was biased there.
Okay. Now, and Trevor, you still get to call great races at Del Mar, like the Pacific Classic, but no more Breeders' Cup, no more Triple Crown. Do you miss calling those races at all?
Those are the worst of the worst of the worst. It's the only day that's not fun. Okay. I mean, Pacific Classic Day, you look forward to it. It's fun. It's exciting. There's a big crowd. Breeders' Cup, that's not fun. That's just sheer pressure. And, you know, you can do 100 races, 99 you do well, and you mess up one, and all they talk about is the one. Mm-hmm. So, no, that is not a fun day. I can't speak for them, but I'd say any announcer would say the same thing.
Interesting. Now, as far as Del Mar goes, do you have a retirement date in mind? Again, you still call an excellent race. You love Del Mar. Do you see an end, or are you just going to let that answer pop into your head one day?
Yes, definitely. No, thank you very much for saying that. I feel like I'm the same now as I was 30 years ago. I still have enthusiasm. The day I don't have enthusiasm, obviously, is the day I leave. But I always look at race calling at the first race today. It's a Wednesday afternoon at Del Mar. But there's a groom involved. There's an owner involved. There's the $2 bettor involved. He doesn't care if he's got $2 on the first on Wednesday afternoon or $2 on the Kentucky Derby. That's his bet. Mm-hmm. So I owe it to them to try 100%. I like to think there's never been a race where I've said, I'll just get through this and go on to the next one. Never. So I try my hardest. And as far as retiring, no. Again, I've said to my wife, it's like, let's just do this until I don't want to do it anymore. You know, in a way, it gives me something to break up the year. I can sit on my farm 12 months of the year, but it's lovely sitting on the farm for 9 months of the year. And then come around the middle of June, you start saying, wow, Del Mar's coming up. And, you know, we stay in a beautiful place down here. As we've said already, the weather's fine, the racing's great. No, I'm enjoying Del Mar.
Okay. Now, Trevor, this all started some 35 years ago. Well, it started from an American standpoint with you calling these races at Oaktree. You were an unknown from a foreign country. Looking back on it now, how surreal is it that you've had the career that you've had? It has to have been well beyond your wildest expectations.
I was lucky. It was serendipity from day one. I was 16 years old in South Africa. I wanted to be a jockey. I got a little too big, so I started calling races from an apartment overlooking the local racetrack. And I went along to the general manager of the local racetrack. It was Greyville Racetrack. It's called Durban Turf Club, to a man called Gerald Lee. And what a noble man. I mean, this was, in England, he would have been a lord. You know, he was very sophisticated, very intelligent. And instead of saying, little kid, stop wasting my time, he sat in a room and he listened to about four of my races. We chatted. I mean, he was my friend and he was probably 60 years old. I was 16. And one day they had two announcers and one of the announcers got a little uppity and he up and left. He just handed in his notice and left. And Gerald Lee, the general manager, was sitting there saying, what about that little kid that's been bothering me? Is he still interested? And he sent a guy around to where I lived, and the guy said, are you still interested in calling races? I said, gee, you bet I am. He said, well, come to the racetrack on Saturday. I think Mr. Lee is going to let you call a race. So I went to the races, called the race, and obviously got the job, and it just went from there. And then another bit of serendipity, where what I call the American Gerald Lee, was a guy called Alan Bolch, who worked at Santa Anita. It was the same thing just a couple of years later. I think I was about 29 then. And I came to Santa Anita and gave Alan Bolsch a tape and said, you know, can you listen to this? And again, he was smart enough to listen to it. He had the far-sightedness to say, you know, this guy's got potential and he's something different. And Dave Johnson was calling the races there, and Dave said, okay, this is my last year. I'm retiring from Santa Anita. And just like Mr. Lee had done, Alan Bolsch said, what about that little kid in South Africa? I wonder if he's still interested. So he sent me a letter, and I said, you bet I'm interested. So, you know, it was the courage and the sagacity and the far-sightedness of Gerald Lee and Alan Bolsch that really made me.
Well, congratulations on a great career, one that is, I'm sure, will continue for many years to come. Trevor, it's been a delight. Thanks for taking part in our TDN podcast. We thank our sponsor, TaylorMade. Trevor, enjoy Del Mar 2018.
I sure will, and thanks for all the accolades. I certainly appreciate it. And I remember you going back to the 80s. You were one of the very few people who were on my side when I said something's got to happen with this whipping. So thank you for that.
Very good. Thank you, Trevor.
Have a good one. Thank you.